At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going to call this the What Could Possibly Go Wrong edition of the broadcast. Today we've got driverless cars, automated language translation in business, and the long, long history of alcohol fermentation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 28th of May today. We've done a whole lot of work on this program on big data, specifically our data, how much of it companies have, and what they do with it. The Federal Trade Commission caught up this week and has come out with a big report on the business of data brokers, companies that collect data on us, create profiles of us using that data, and then sell those profiles to marketers and others. The specifics of this report are kind of amazing. One broker the FTC looked at had 3,000 pieces of data on every single American consumer. Another had more than a billion transactions in its databases. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes it from there.
Data brokers gather up or buy bits of information about us, from public records, online purchases, social media posts, trips to the drugstore.
There's thousands and thousands of data elements on each consumer.
The FTC's Jessica Rich says data brokers use that information to slot us into categories.
The level of specificity and detail are mind-boggling. They have urban scramble, which is a category referring to low-income and minority consumers. They have thrifty elders. They have diabetes interest.
More and more, the stories that are told about us are told through numbers and the collection of data about us.
Joseph Toro is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Some of those stories help people, but a lot of them may be dangerous for us and for the kinds of opportunities we have in life.
Dictating the insurance premiums and interest rates we pay. The FTC calls on Congress to require data brokers be transparent and allow consumers to opt out of having their data sold and used for marketing.
At the end of the day, the FTC makes some pretty good points.
Russell Glass is the CEO of Bizzo. It specializes in creating data profiles of business professionals, which it sells to clients like American Express and UPS.
Nobody really knows what the rules are, right? So there's this self-regulation that some people follow, some people don't. Some degree of smart regulation, I think that'd be a net positive for the industry. Right now, a lot of this is the monster under the bed syndrome, right, where everything seems really scary in the dark.
Bizzo lets the 190 million business people it profiles see the data it's collected on them. Glass says fewer than 1% of people who look at their profiles opt out. The rest want the convenience and the tailored marketing that comes with a data profile. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Speaking of big data, we turn now to driverless cars. Google has just unveiled the second generation of its self-driving automobile. All those tens of thousands of miles of digital street mapping, I guess, have paved the way for Google's dreams of roads packed full of automated cars. The big difference between the new model and the old ones? The prototype of the new model has no brake pedal, no steering wheel, no manual override, so to speak, just a big stop button. So really, passengers are in the complete and total control of Google's software. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more on that.
Imagine for a moment that it's the year 2050. You're watching TV, a movie from the early 2000s. It's a rom-com, and a couple is at the end of a date, about to kiss awkwardly in their car, when your 8-year-old grandkid walks into the room, looks at the screen, and says, "What's that round thing?" That, you answer, is a steering wheel.
Now, for some people, again, this might not be a big deal. For some people, it might actually be a benefit.
Tilo Kozlowski is an analyst with Gartner. He says the self-driving car presents us with all kinds of opportunities. The elderly would be less isolated. Blind people could hop in a car and go anywhere at any time. And the designated driver could get hammered. And everyone would be on safer roads because traffic could be coordinated.
The question that we will have to ask ourselves at some point as a society is, are we willing to give up some of that freedom in exchange for fewer accidents and even improved traffic flow?
Along with that freedom, we would also be giving up even more of our privacy. Tech companies would not only know our movements at all times, they would have control over them.
The best forecast we've seen by IHS, I believe they said that by 2035, they predicted about 54 million automated vehicles on the road.
Eric Noble is with CarLab. To put that in perspective, that's roughly a quarter of all the cars on the road. The IHS report, titled Emerging Technologies, Autonomous Cars, Not If, But When, predicted that nearly all of the vehicles in use are likely to be self-driving sometime after 2050. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
It was, all in all, a fairly placid day on Wall Street. No big economic news. The president's foreign policy speech didn't bother traders too much. Whole lot of nothing, really. But still, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Good news has been in short supply in Detroit of late. There is the bankruptcy, of course. And this week, a new report from a federal task force that says as many as 40,000 buildings in that city ought to be removed, and that it's going to cost way more to do it than anybody thought. Erica Gerson chairs the Detroit Land Bank Authority, which is in charge of dealing with the broken down properties that Detroit itself owns, and which is going to be plenty busy with carrying out this new report. Ms. Gerson, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I imagine right about now you're sitting back trying to digest this thing, huh?
That would be a fair statement. It's 330 pages. That's a lot of digesting.
What are you going to do first? How do you go about a task which, I'm overstating only a little bit, involves knocking down a big part of a major American city?
You're absolutely right. And we've probably got 70 or 80,000 structures we're going to have to deal with. One of the problems here is that there are houses that have been sitting empty for 3 years to 5 years, and they're not getting any better. So we have to get our hands on them faster. And one of the ways we're doing that is a nuisance abatement program, which allows us to exert the power of common law nuisance. I have a staff of attorneys that go out and put big posters on houses that say, call this number within 72 hours or your property will be seized by the Detroit Land Bank. That tends to get the attention of the landlords. We're finding that a lot of them are fixing their properties up, which is exactly what we want.
This is an impolitic question to ask, but do you sometimes feel like the Grim Reaper? I mean, putting up signs like that, you know.
Well, but you know what? Out of the 78 that we posted the first time, 35 of them are in good condition. We're saving them, and we're going to auction them. And we'll put new neighbors in them who'll fix them up, buy them from us for cheap on eBay, and then put some money into it and make it a home.
How are you going to pay for this? It's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars more than anybody figured out to do this.
For the moment, we're doing a little bit of wishing, hoping, and praying. Yeah, we have $52 million from the federal government, which we're using this year, and that'll pretty much take us through October, taking down like 250 houses this month and 300 next month and 600 or 700 the month after that. After that, we hope that as part of the bankruptcy settlement and plan of adjustment, our emergency manager has tried very hard to set aside $450 million to combat blight over the next 5 years. That's a big chunk of change.
How does one, how do you I guess, to ask a better question. How do you stay positive in the face of a report like this and what you see when you go out and drive around some of these neighborhoods?
I have a brand new answer to that from yesterday, and it was a great story.
Okay.
The first neighborhood that we put up our scary posters in was Marygrove. Beautiful old neighborhood. A lot of firefighters and policemen used to live in that area right near a university. But it's gone way downhill, and there's maybe 8 or 10 houses on every block that are abandoned. They've turned into drug houses. They're a mess. Yesterday, people saw a man, and they thought he was scrapping. They thought he was tearing down the beautiful gutters on a great old house that was abandoned. They called the police, got there very fast. 5 minutes later, the lady looking out her window said, "Why are the cops standing on the lawn instead of arresting that guy? They're all laughing." She went out. She said, "What's going on? Why didn't you arrest him?" Turned out that was one of the houses that we had posted, and he was putting up brand new gutters. The lady said she hadn't seen anybody do that in that neighborhood in 20 years. It never occurred to her. That's what keeps you going.
Erica Gerson is the chair of the Detroit Land Bank Authority, with a new report out saying she's got a whole lot of work to do. Ms. Gerson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We're going to spend the next year or so on a new education project. We're calling it Learning Curve. It's about technology in the classroom, how computers and the internet are changing just about everything in education, the way teachers teach, the way kids learn, and the way businesses are trying to cash in. To get things started today, a quick history lesson about technology in the classroom. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has it.
It's 1976. Liza Loop goes to a meeting of the Homebrew Computer Club in Silicon Valley.
They were engineers and hobbyists and all kinds of neat people, among them Steve Wozniak.
Yeah, that's Steve Wozniak, the guy who co-founded Apple Computers.
And I stood up and said, "I'm doing a public access computer center and I'm taking computers into schools."
Pretty run-of-the-mill stuff today. But back then, it was almost radical. Woz was intrigued. He found her after.
And said, "This is great. This is why I'm building this computer."
And a month later, he came to her computer club with a gift.
And it was the first Apple.
Apple One. For everything that Apple's become, its first computer just didn't work that well. Loop says it took forever to load BASIC. And then after 25 minutes, the whole thing crashed.
I took it back to Woz and said, "You know, I really think this is a great idea. I'm all for it and I really want to use it, but I can't use this machine in a classroom. You're going to have to do something else."
In some ways, that's been the story of education technology for decades. Great hope, ambition, often expense, followed by disappointment. Way back in 1922, Thomas Edison thought he had it all figured out.
Edison made a statement that he thought that within a decade or so, schools would be completely revolutionized, that films would be the major means via which learners acquired skills and knowledge.
Robert Reeser is dean in the College of Education at Florida State University. Turns out Edison was a better inventor than prognosticator. Films fizzled out. They were expensive. Projectors were unreliable. It was hard to find the right film for the right class. Then came...
Hello, boys and girls. How are you today?
Radio. And broadcasts like this from Wisconsin School of the Air.
Now, boys and girls, get into a circle. I want to talk to you a little bit. I want you to...
School boards and universities, even commercial networks like CBS and NBC, poured money into creating classroom broadcasts, textbooks of the air. But...
that enthusiasm died out.
Enter teaching machines with names like Cycloteacher, Instructocard, the Edumator. Here's psychologist B.F. Skinner in 1954.
As soon as a student has written his response, he operates the machine and learns immediately whether he is right or wrong.
Dozens of companies made these devices in the early 60s. Turns out buttons and levers weren't a great way to learn. Which brings us to television.
The following is from a cooperative project for acquiring skills essential to learn.
TV combined sight and sound. It could be live. It could help with teacher shortages. The Ford Foundation invested millions. The feds pitched in cash. By 1971, researchers estimate more than $100 million had been poured into educational television. Again, says Reeser, same story.
We see one medium after another coming along, a lot of enthusiasm for that medium, followed by disappointment in the extent to which that medium changed the nature of instruction taking place in classrooms.
So when computers became a force in the classroom in the early 80s, when the numbers tripled between 80 and 82, and tripled again by 84, and Time magazine ran a cover story called "Here Come the Micro Kids," educators were skeptical. But now they're reconsidering. Maybe this time is actually different. Themis Barangas is chief technology director at LA Unified School District.
We're in the cusp now of that big revolution.
LA Unified has bet big on tech, $1 billion big, to give every student an iPad. And around the country, other schools, districts, the government are buying in.
I think we're starting to see a maturity in the user-friendliness and the interfaces with media and technology.
In other words, the machines work. All you have to do is turn them on. The challenge is finding the best way to use them for individual kids.
And look for activities, learning experiences, face-to-face experiences, online, each other experiences in such a way that I can really create a personalized, individualized learning plan for every child.
Personalized learning. That's the tech promise we're being sold now. Computers and tablets and smartphones and the internet will allow our kids to learn in the right way for them at the right speed for them. And data will be gathered along the way to let teachers know what's working and what isn't. Companies and investors are spending billions to make change happen for real this time.
A lot of this is happening really fast. You need to slow down.
That's USC education professor Patricia Birch.
You see this in a number of the big districts. So EdTech initiatives are being rolled out within a year or 2 years to all students.
The risk, she says, is that you don't want students to be guinea pigs.
You don't want to be working out the bugs on kids who can't afford, no kid can afford to lose a year of school.
Because, as we've learned over time, not all educational technology is worthwhile. And the promise is just the beginning. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You can add your personal history of technology and education to the one we have put together. And check out our Tumblr as well. It's all at marketplace.org/learningcurve. Coming up, barkeep, make mine a double.
The marketing for all of those products will want you to believe in the tradition and the history and the old guys out in the backwoods. But of course, when you really go to a place like Jim Beam, let's say, it's a chemical plant.
Kind of takes the charm out of it, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. But first, let's do the numbers. Light trading and thus something of a meh day on Wall Street. Today, the Dow Industrials off 42 points, about 0.25%, closed at 16,633. The NASDAQ off 11 points, nearly 0.3%, 42.25. The S&P 500 lopped off 2 points, just about 0.1%, ended things at 1909. Shares in Toll Brothers built up more than 2% today after the biggest luxury home builder in the country said its quarterly profit more than doubled. Some of its peers got a boost, too. Shares in D.R. Horton up more than 0.8%. KB Home shares rose 0.3%. From the world of corporate earnings, it was, yeah, I'll take the purse, but I'm going to have to think about the shoes, all right? By which I mean shares in the accessory retailer Michael Kors were up 1.3% on word quarterly profit was also way up. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its second estimate for first quarter gross domestic product. Wisconsin joined the Union on May 29, 1848. And kids compete in the Scripps National Spelling Bee Championship Finals. You can watch it live on ESPN while gripping your dictionary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. David Weinberg was telling us about the driverless cars that Google is going to build. So here's another living in the future story for you. Skype and its corporate parent Microsoft are going to unveil a live translation service later this year. You have a conversation with somebody in another language, and a moment later, there is the translation. The business opportunities, as they say, are endless. Dan Bobkoff reports.
Star Trek had a universal translator to decipher alien languages. The professor in Futurama built one, too.
So far, it only translates into an incomprehensible dead language.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Crazy gibberish.
But now, this kind of thing is a reality.
Hello, Diana. How are you doing?
Hallo, Diana. Wie dir es geht?
That's Microsoft's Gurdeep Singh Paul demonstrating Skype translator with his German colleague at the Code conference this week.
Yeah, well, I think it has some syntax problems, but it's good.
Alice Lurie teaches at the University of South Carolina's Darla Moore School of Business and speaks German. She passed the phone to her colleague Ken Erickson, a business anthropologist at the school, who was a bit more skeptical.
It lulls you into a sense of comfort where you should be, not so comfortable.
A lot can get lost in translation in international business. Erickson says Skype Translator might be useful for simple things like scheduling a meeting, but
if you want to negotiate a contract, you'd better not rely on something like this.
Microsoft admits the technology is still not ready for prime time. Raul Castagnon of the Yankee Group thinks it will eventually be huge for business.
Well, the way it makes more sense to introduce the technology is through consumer applications.
So we get to play with it first. I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Ich bin Dan Bobkoff für Marktplatz.
There comes a point in a lot of people's weeks when they walk into a bar, they have a seat, and they order a drink. Everything that happens before the instant that drink arrives, from the growing of the crops to fermentation and distillation to the cost of it all, is something that Adam Rogers has been researching for years. He's written it all up in his new book. It's called Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Loyal listeners to this program will know that I am a beer aficionado, so I took your book to heart, especially that bit where you say basically beer is the foundation of all of civilization.
Sure. Yeah, I think that that's non-controversial. Is that did someone disagree with that? To me, it's one of the founding moments of civilization, where we decided we're going to ferment. We're going to do this on purpose.
It's worth pointing out that a brewery or a distillery, or in some respects a vineyard, I imagine, is a factory, right? It's an industrial place.
It really is. And the marketing for all of those products will want you to believe in the tradition and the history. And in the case of bourbon, let's say, the old guys out in the backwoods. But of course, when you really go to a place like Jim Beam, let's say, it's a chemical plant, you know? But they make something that's really beautiful. They make a delicious thing to drink. But it's still, this is a chemical process. There's technology here. And in fact, the thing that I think we could stand to appreciate more about distillation is that it's one of the great examples of human engineering. It's us taking our environment and making something that nobody else could make, making something better, improving on what nature gives us.
There's a moment where you go over to Scotland with your dad and you sit down, and I forget if it's in a bar or actually at a distillery, and you have a sip of the product on offer, and you look at each other and you both say, ooh, this is going to be an expensive hobby. The good ones can cost you a little bit.
I am sad to say that I have been largely priced out of the single malt market. It's a real bummer for me because I love that stuff. But fortunately, what's happened in this country in the last, not even really 20 years, but 10, is that there are enough craft distillers making enough interesting stuff that you can really taste some pretty good things for not as much money. And so I have been branching out.
It occurs to me that the foundational ingredients of what you are talking about in this book. It's water and, hops and some malt and all kinds of other stuff that goes into it. They are not in and of themselves that dear, that expensive. So what is it that we're paying for, whether it's, an expensive beer or an expensive bottle of scotch?
You're definitely paying for a value add in the process, for sure. Now, in some cases, the substrate, the grain, or the if they're making wine, the grapes, they can be more expensive because they're rarer, or because they're getting an organic product, or because they're getting something that nobody else grows, or that costs a lot. And in fact, the price of barley and corn are commodity crops, mm-hmm. but those prices do vary as well. A big bourbon distiller buys so much corn that they don't. That's not where their cost is, but their cost will be in how long it takes to make something and in aging. For wine and for distilled spirits especially, one of the barriers to entry for a craft distiller is that it costs a lot of money to sit on this stuff for 10 years, you know? Mm. That's something that a big distillery can do that a craft distiller cannot, because they need to get product out the door. So you are paying for their expertise and making sure that it tastes good when they're done.
Yeah, and you're paying for time, right?
And time.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it possible for you now, at the end of however many years of what I'm sure was grueling research for this book, can you walk into a bar now and just enjoy a drink?
Absolutely. That I can still do. I can't enjoy as many of them as well, I used to.
That's, you're getting old, man. That's what that is.
That is what that is, yeah. Yes. But yes, the book has only increased my appreciation for being able to walk into a bar that reflects some idiosyncrasies of its owner and of its, you know, drinks manager, and to be able to look at the bartender and say, give me something weird.
Adam Rogers is the articles editor at Wired Magazine. He's got a new book out. It is called Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of unlikely corporate bedfellows, the long-awaited, much-rumored, and somewhat head-scratching deal between Apple and Beats, the headphone and music streaming company co-founded by Dr. Dre, is now apparently official. Apple made the announcement this afternoon. $3 billion is the price tag. Dr. Dre and his co-founder Jimmy Iovine will become Apple employees when all is said and done. Apple CEO Tim Cook called them kindred spirits, which I just don't see. But okay, whatever. Not my money. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this, what, Wednesday it is. Today, the Dow off 42 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ gave back 11 points, almost 0.3%. The S&P 500 lopped off 2 points, just about 0.1%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.